1, 1 through 3. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord and the day of vengeance to our God, to comfort all who mourn, to console those who mourn in Zion, to give them beauty for ashes, the oil of joy for mourning, the garment of praise and the spirit of heaviness, that they may be called trees of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, that he may be glorified. That is what Jesus Christ does for us. There once was a general who gave orders to his captain on what ground he wanted them to take. To the first one he says, "I want you to take that forest." The captain saluted and laughed. To the second he says, "I want you to take those hills." This captain also laughed. To the third he says, "I want you to take the top of that cliff by scaling straight up it. Oh, and one more thing. You will be in a wheelchair without the use of your legs. Now go." The third man hesitated and said, "But sir, that is impossible." And the general says, "Don't worry, for I'll be with you. And I have the power to lift you up even over a sheer cliff." Psalm 91:15. "He shall call upon me, and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him." God gives the trial he has allotted for each of us, and he determines the beginning, the severity, and the end. For some, it is a forest, for others, a hill, and for a few, a sheer cliff. But in his mercy, he tells them that he will go with them, and with that help, they really can scale a mountain. For those of you who have not already been given your assignment of trial to conquer, it might be relatively easy to think, "Of course I'll be strong enough to scale any mountain, because I feel confident I'm able to handle it." But there is something that you must realize first before you attempt to scale anything. And it is this: we are all weak apart from God, every single last one of us. And you can't scale a mountain, up a sheer cliff, in a wheelchair, so to speak, without God. It can't be done. Why, you can't even make your own heartbeat. And God could reduce any one of us to a jelly if he wanted to, if he hammered long enough. Psalm 18:29. "For by you I can run against a troop, and by my God I can leap over a wall." With trial, he is going somewhere with it. There is a plan that is for an ultimate good, and he knows just how far he can push us to accomplish his purposes. All you need to know is he will never give you more than you can handle with him. That's the important part. He is good. He will use it for good because he loves you. And again, I'll quote Romans 8:28, "And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purposes." In fact, part of the reason for the trial is that you will learn to lean on him and gain what is precious, becoming more like Christ. He does take your hand and leads us to the toughest situations. And with this strength, we can scale a cliff because he is the hedge that keeps us from falling. He can be trusted. If I've learned anything in my 10 years of winter, it is that he can be trusted, even if he takes you far, far beyond which you thought you could have handled. And for me, I thought he had done just that. But God was merciful and gave us a series of smaller trials to test us. First, in the upward cycle of struggle, learn, grow, to prepare us for the much bigger ones. And we stand on the backs of what we learned from previous trials to handle the next ones. So, what was my situation that I learned to trust him in? Okay, we have some photos. We have had a hard yet good life on the mission field, where we have had continuous trials that felt like we were going from the fire into the frying pan. This is par for the course in the front lines of the mission field. Life just isn't easy. And we were assigned to do a translation of the Bible into a little-known language called Bakwe, spoken by roughly 13,000 people in the rainforest region of Ivory Coast. These people did not have a written language. By the time we arrived, there were only 6 known Christians who were evangelized by mistake at an Assemblies of God rally. The area was accessible by road, but had no communication options with the outside world, and little in the way of amenities. The mission was going to be a difficult one, and in many ways, we were eager for it. I will not go into details here of how we settled in and started, since you can read more about it in my book, At the Edge of the Village, at Canon Press. But in summary, we picked a central village, asked for land, built a house from scratch, and once settled in with our 2 young children, a 2 and a 1-year-old, Chaba then had to learn the language without aid of any books to guide him. and soon became the only white man in the world fluent in Bakwe. He then had to create the alphabet, figure out the phonetics and grammar of the language, learn more about the culture to find out how they view the world, then find a team of Bakwe men to help him translate and do literacy. In the meantime, I was pregnant with our third child and keeping track of little kids in our homestead, trying to keep them out of trouble in the jungle of our backyard where cobras lurked in the forest and a stray cock or two in the hand-dug pond. Then after our fourth child was born, I was quite busy homeschooling them all, managing our menagerie of animals and plants and living on a very basic level, sort of like one step up from camping, but I loved it. I also was trying to learn the language too, but that didn't quite happen with everything else. I had a workable knowledge of French on a basic level, and I had the Bakwe readings down. That was about it. Though challenging, all the above was fine and good. But now, let's add into the mix living with an aggressive and forthright people who had a vastly different idea about privacy and manners, all within a stone's throw away. They needed Christ, and that was why we were there. The challenge of dealing with them 24/7 would be a big one, but that is not the scope of this talk. On top of the above challenges, there were others. We were dealing on a daily basis with living in the tropics and all the diseases and parasites that went with it. Some of these were pretty life-threatening. We were far away from a doctor with no internet and no phone. Add into the mix the ever-increasing instability of the region with roving armed gangs and layer the threat of a civil war that would escalate to where our lives would end up being in danger. And that was a cliff the Lord had asked us to take. And he asked me to take it with a fraction of my usual energy. Not only that, he would ask us to do it without complaining, fear, or worry. The bar of obedience wasn't going to change with each new challenge. It would just make it that much harder to reach it. And that was where God came in. How to handle these things didn't come all at once, but over time. So what is the purpose of trials? Trials are meant to sharpen us, teach us to fight, stand firm in God's strength. My intention here is to tell you about some of the trials he went through and what he taught me through them in hopes that they will bless you as well. You may not have the same trials, but the concepts are the same, and everyone can benefit from the fundamentals. So, what did I learn? How to trust God with my children. Okay, this is highly ironic. God has a sense of humor in taking someone who is a natural warrior, me, afraid of sickness, death, and suffering, and putting her in Africa, way off in the backcountry, in one of the most dangerous places, health-wise, on Earth, at least where the microbe level is concerned. Well, we were to get some firsthand experience with some of these diseases, and let me tell you about some. Andreas, my second son, was little at the time, about 2 or 3, and he got sick with a virus, and then a few days later, he couldn't walk. We didn't know what happened, but polio came to our minds, and we knew that there was still polio in Africa. He was vaccinated, but sometimes the vaccines don't fully cover. We were 9 hours away from competent medical help, and the trip was a long and hard one, so we were pretty much on our own. I wondered, does my child have polio or not? What do we do now? So how do you, in the face of some perceived danger, train your mind not to default to worry? These type of things don't come naturally, but must be trained into your way of operating. It is like a war. A soldier is trained not to fear. It's a choice. So let's take a look at Ephesians 6, 10 through 18, where you have to put on the whole armor of a warrior. You can go over it yourself more in detail, but I want to emphasize taking up the shield of faith, with which you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the enemy. Let's define terms. Faith is believing in what you can't see, Hebrews 11:1. And I might also add, in what you can't feel. Women often use feelings as an indicator of reality. I feel, therefore it is. Where actually feelings are one of the worst indicators of reality, depending upon how much sleep you got, what your hormones are doing, etc. So, if you can't feel God's presence, it doesn't mean he is not there. There is a shield of his promises, of who he is and what he will do. And with that shield, you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the enemy. What are darts? These darts are the lies that cause fears, worries, and a lack of hope in God. That is how the enemy attacks. In a heavy trial, he could lie to you constantly that all is hopeless, and you might as well save yourself because God won't. And then you fear. So what do? You stand on the promises in God's word, despite how you feel at the moment. You bring up your shield, and you use it. But as I said before, it doesn't happen all at once. If a dart gets through, and you're on the floor in a puddle of worry, You need to confess that to God. He then reaches down, pulls you up, puts a shield back in your hand, and teaches you how to use it again. Sometimes in learning to fight, you are more down than up. But with perseverance, a lot of confession, and a repeatedly helpful and good God, you learn if you don't give up. And as you learn, you begin to stand more than you're down. Then as you conquer in an area, you can now stand on the back of what you learned previously to help you for what is to come, both for yourself and later to help others. That is a concept: struggle, learn, grow. Stand on what you learn to use it for what is to come. So, child not walking, what did we do? We and our cook prayed, looked to God, cried out for help, and the next day Andrea started walking again. I asked a doctor later who said it could have been a viral arthritic fever, but I don't know what happened, except that we cried out to God, and he answered. James 1:5, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, it will be given to him. And there were other trials too. I won't go into it very much, but Chava spiked 104-degree fever in 1 hour, and we were away from medical help, and I had to decide what drugs that he was going to take, and just cried out to God, saying, help. And then, you know, I was looking at all these drugs with really serious side effects, and I felt just veering towards wanting a piece about that, gave it to him, and the fever came down, and he was okay. So in these dire circumstances, we need God. We take him to task, and he comes through. So all these prepared us for the bigger one, typhoid. We didn't know what I had, but I was very, very ill. But now we're standing on the backs of previous trials, so we put that into practice. This doesn't mean I didn't have to battle with worry still. It just meant my jumping off place was on a firmer foundation. We had just gotten to the village wondering what to do, and it is hard to travel back to the city, and traveling alone could really wipe me out. So we prayed, asking God to be very specific if we should go back to the city or not. The next day, Chaba was feeling he should at least pack up and be ready. As he was doing so, I felt my strength starting to slip away. It was the weirdest feeling, like there was no bottom and I was going under. As I was feeling this, I felt the word shoot into my head, I could take you. My first reaction was, what about Chaba and the children? Who will take care of them? I felt the words again say, I will take care of them. And I knew he would. Then I released them all and I felt a peace. At the same time this was happening, Chaba was looking down at me on the bed, and these words shot into his head, I could take her. Chaba struggled with that, but finally handed it over to God to submit to his will, and he felt a peace. At that very moment, I felt the ground come back up under me, and I no longer felt I was slipping down. I was still very ill, but I didn't think I would die anytime soon, and that at least was reassuring. It also was all the confirmation that Chaba needed to get us right back to the city. And that's where we found out I had typhoid. It was a long road ahead of me, 1.5 years of a hard-going recovery. But at least I knew that God would take care of us. So, did the trials end there? Was that more than anyone should have to go through in their life? I thought so, but not according to God. He was going to use the last trial for us to stand on so we could tackle the upcoming ones. There were more tests and trials that we learned in the struggle, learn, grow process. By now, we had gone through threats by local armed gangs and a violent election where we had to hunker down and wait out the unrest until the elections were over. Then there was more sickness, some snake encounters, all getting us ready for the bigger ones, which started with a growing weakness in my own body that no one had an answer for. Being weak on the mission field where life was hard was a challenge, but that was only the beginning. After a couple years, we decided to go back on furlough for 6 months to look at colleges for Hunts, but we had to stay much longer, because a war broke out that would also break our hearts as we watched a country that we knew and loved go into deep turmoil. Then, when we tried to go back in a brief lull, we never made it to the village because we ended up arriving at a time where armed gangs were out to get the French. Since we looked very French, we had to escape out of the country in one piece, and that wasn't going to be easy, especially since there were death threats out for whites coming now over the radio. So we ended up entering Ivory Coast in actually one of the most dangerous times for whites in the history of the nation. And we are still confident that God wanted us there, even led us there for a reason. The country had been unstable, but there was an uneasy peace at the moment, so we wanted to head up to the village, but stopped at the guest house in San Pedro on the ocean first so I could recover from the trip and regain a little bit of strength. Because remember, I'm on just a fraction of my normal strength, but we still went back anyhow. While there, something happened in the country that I don't have time to go into now, that would cause riots and gangs all over the nation to take to the streets looking for French people with the intent to harm them and their property. We were supposed to go to the village the next day, but couldn't because of riots going on around the country. We were told by an inside source that an armed gang would be traveling that night in San Pedro in search for French, and we needed to get ready for flight since we were white. We were only two families there at the time, and each family packed an emergency bag of essentials. And it's really interesting what you will put in a small pack. When night fell, the women and children went back to the farthest apartment situated by a back door that led out into the high forest beyond. Chaba and the other husband, Greg, would be armed with what they had on hand, Greg with a double-headed axe and Chaba with only a machete. They would stay by the gate all night and keep watch. We had walkie-talkies with us, and if a gang was coming, they would radio for us to slip out into the forest, and they would follow, only staying and using the weapons to buy us time to get out. I thought about my husband. Wow, that's a man for you, willing to put himself between us and an armed gang of drunk and dangerous men, using only a machete for a weapon. Anyhow, the time is too short to go into it all, but three gunshots were fired in the near distance. We were ordered to get out into the forest, and I tell you, we were so pathetic. We should have had some type of fire drill or something beforehand to wake them. It was bad. Anyhow, what with trying to wake kids up and them all wanting to use the bathroom before we went out into the forest. Come on, let's go. We finally got out the back door, sooner or later, with a dog and a parrot because the other girl didn't want to leave her pets behind. And they wouldn't shut up, and they threatened to blow our cover. I mean, the dog didn't know why he was going into the forest, and neither did the pair. And all the wife, woo, woo. And I suggested, well, leave the animals behind. No, we can't leave them behind, but oh well. Anyhow, so we went into the rainforest. And boy, I tell you, talk about a stealth mission. So we slipped out. We found a very dark path in the forest. And this is the rainforest, so it's huge. And you're just walking into a dark wall of vegetation with just a little hole right down at the bottom. We went a little ways and we hunkered down. A half hour later, Chaba found us and said that we could come out now. The gang hadn't arrived, so it was a false alarm, and we could go back to sleep, and they would keep watch all night in case the gang came back. Actually, the gang was fairly close, but they stopped at a resort on the beach. The pickings were so good, and the men were too drunk to move on, so we were spared. I will leave that scene now, even though I am in the process of writing a book on how we did manage to get out of the country. But let me close that scene with this. After coming out of the forest with a gun and cannon fire still going on in the distance, I was standing outside with Chaba looking up at the stars. I said to Chaba, look at them. It is so peaceful up there, while down here there is such turmoil and danger. We have the great concern now of trying to get out of the country tomorrow in one piece. And it's almost like God doesn't have a care in the world. And Chaba said, he doesn't. God is the same God both here and up there. And he is in complete control of everything. That is why he is not worried, and neither should we be. And that was rather reassuring. I'll leave that scene and go on to another. After a harrowing and lengthy evacuation that spanned three countries, which eventually landed us in Mali, I immediately got the influenza on top of everything else. Remember, I only have a fraction of my energy, so I'm doing all this, which is taxing a normal person's strength to the max. And then, at the very end, I got the influenza, and I crashed down so dangerously low that our church wanted us to return immediately, but I was actually too weak to be even wheeled in a wheelchair onto the plane. We had to wait until I regained enough strength for that. I was really that bad off. How did it feel? It was a weakness so profound that I didn't just feel tired. There wasn't a word to describe it. I felt dangerously like the bottom of life was about to drop out again, and me with it. It felt worse than the weakness of the worst influenza and one that never ends. Add on to that the feeling of grogginess and fuzzy thinking, like you just woke up in the middle of the night feeling drugged, and you begin to see what my life was like for many years. And the worst of it, which was the whole first year, I was suffering 24/7. There was no let-up. I had little positive coming in outside of my family being around me. I woke up and felt horrid, like I had to recover from the night. I then felt horrid all day and needed the night to recover from the day. And so it went on at least a year before it abated somewhat, and there began to be very small windows, like an hour here or there, where I went from feeling horrid to a little less horrid. I wouldn't feel normal until probably about 10 years later. something like that. 8 years later, I forget. Okay, Chaba was excellent in counseling me during it. When I was lying down in the bed in our apartment in Mali, and the bed was a worn old mattress that I hit the bottom with, he knew he had to get my mind turned in the right direction, so he got me to actively think. He said, "Do you have a foam mattress?" Because a lot of people in Africa don't. They sleep on mats in the floor, or the mattress is made of straw. And I said, "Yes, I did." And he told me, he says, "Be thankful for it." "Do you have a pillow?" I said, "Yes, I did." And he told me to thank God for that. So when my mind wanted to go in the gutter of despair, Chaba was teaching me how to fight, not to go down there. And it was from choosing to thank God for what I did have, even though to me it seemed like I was scraping the barrel. There is always something to thank God for. So choose to rest your mind there. Psalm 94:19. "And the multitude of my anxieties within me, your comforts delight my soul." I did fight to keep my mind from sinking to the depths, but I remember during a particularly hard time where I just caved in and I felt despair. Despair is when you give up hope. I was to learn that God knew when I couldn't hold on and would always give me something to lift me up again, and often it was his presence. Psalm 94:18. "If I say, my foot slips, your mercy, O Lord, will hold me up." During this particular time, I was suffering so much and nothing was relieving me that I went to the sink and turned on the tap and let the water run over my hands because it felt good. I needed something, anything that felt good. As I let the water run over my hands, I absentmindedly cupped them to receive the incoming water. And when it filled up, I let it go, only to repeat the process and keep filling, letting go, keep filling. And as I did so, just kind of hunkered down with what little strength I had, I felt a conversation develop in my head. "What are you doing?" Me, filling my hands with water. "What happens when you let the water go?" Me, "It fills up again." And no matter how many times you empty your hands, it will always keep filling up again because the tap will never run dry since it's connected with a source. I was very deeply moved and encouraged by that because I knew no matter how empty I felt or how many more bad things would happen to me, the source of God's love, strength, and help would never run dry. I could count on that. I did slowly climb up a little over time. Here's the progression. It took 6 months before I could do small tasks like fold clothes, knowing how to take over the kitchen, and she really rose up to it. It took 8 months before I was strong enough to walk into a doctor's office. I couldn't even go to a doctor before then. I was too weak. 18 months before I was strong enough to be wheeled onto an airplane to fly back home before I'd crash down again. I would then spend years in relative isolation, too weak to do much of anything ordinary. Like I couldn't sit through a church service, so I laid down behind the curtain, backstage. I was really out of the line of normal fellowship. So in this state, I was to process the great grief and loss of the war with a foggy brain and emotions that ran chronically low due to my condition. And to make matters more challenging, I am by nature a person who loves to get out in nature, be with people, and be busy doing things, all of which were no longer very feasible for me. And it didn't look like it would end. I had to make a decision here. I could either pull back in bitterness and despair because God had messed up my life, or I could look at my life the way it was, knowing it may never change, and decide to live it anyhow to the best of my ability and run to the one who gave me the trial for comfort and healing. I made the choice to run to him. In that time, God's presence was there, teaching, giving hope, lifting up. He taught me many things like how to handle the what-ifs. Remember that something was drastically wrong with me and no one knew what. Not a good place to be for someone prone to worry. Here is an illustration. I call it the doors, and some of you know this. Worry is like being in a room with 10 doors. They're all shut, and they're right in front of you. These doors represent all the possibilities of what might happen in the future about a particular situation that consumes you. Since the future is not yours to know, you don't actually know which door you will walk through eventually. But there will come a time soon when one door will be opened and you will have to walk through it. In the meantime, the not knowing part is very hard, and you decide to go over to take a peek behind the first door, which is labeled worst case scenario number one. You try it and it opens, so you walk through the door and down its virtual path, playing out what could happen if you were later to enter the store. You experience in your mind one what if after the other. As you do, you become more anxious and even weep at the sad events and final ending of this path. This traumatizes you so much that you rush back to the room and you shut the door. You are shaken. How could this possibly happen to you? Maybe it won't, because there's still 9 other doors. So you creep over to worst case scenario door number 2, open it and walk down its path. Again, you play out all that could happen with each situation more horrible than the last, and in a panic, you rush out the door and shut it as well. Will you leave the future to God? No, of course not, because the not knowing part is killing you. So you take matters into your own hand and open the rest of the doors, one by one, and experience in your mind all their ever-increasing stories of gloom and destruction. At the end, you are exhausted. Because of opening all those doors, you are now an anxiety-ridden individual and no more the wiser in knowing what will actually become of you. So my question is this: why do you do this to yourself? And the answer to it all is simple. Take your hand off the doorknobs. Don't even go down there. When the future becomes the present, God will take your hand and lead you through a door and walk you down the path that is allotted for you, and you will be okay. In other words, God is not in what, the future is not real. So when you go down those paths, you're playing out something in your mind that is not real. God's not with you, so you don't even have the help. When reality comes and a door opens, God's going to be right there. He's going to take your hand. He's going to go there with you. You're going to get help. So playing it out in the future, you're going there by yourself. And that's why you can become anxious. You can only get the help when the time comes and he'll be right with you. And that is what he did for me. Hebrews 13:5, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So to make a long story really short, after 10 years of that prison, God opened up the door and let me free. It happened all at once, almost miraculously. At least that is what it felt like. What I had was severe sleep apnea where I stopped breathing 84 times in an hour for various lengths of time. I wasn't getting enough oxygen. I wasn't getting enough REM sleep, and that's where true rest and restoration of the brain happens. With my newfound strength and energy pouring into my body, I remember thinking, this must be what it is like to wake up and find yourself whole and in heaven. It was that amazingly unreal and drastic, and yet God had hid the very simple solution for me for about 10 years. And he knew what he was doing, and he was and is still good. God is never on trial. He was going somewhere with it for the building up of not only myself, but of the body. There is blessing hidden in the trials. When you put your hand in God's and go through it together, you get the blessing. If you pull away from him, you are doubly hit, first with the trial and secondly now without the blessing. So run to him no matter how hard it gets. God determines the start, finish of each trial as specifically tailored for you. If I could not control what happened to my body, I at least knew I could control what happened in my mind, because some of the biggest burdens that we carry are in our minds. So I had to learn how to pare down the burdens I was carrying since I was so weak. Here's a few basics on how to lighten the load. Accept the process and who gave you the trial. It was helpful to recognize who gave the trial and that I could trust him even if I didn't know why he was being so severe with me. Part of the energy drain is fighting God. 2, choose to be thankful. With everything seeming out of control, you still do have a lot to be thankful for. Let your minds dwell there. It's a choice. Proverbs 18:10, the name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous run to it and are safe. And I imagine the tower running into it. You're safe emotionally, you know. 3, take away any extra burdens. Matthew 11:28 through 30. Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. It is amazing how many burdens we actually put upon ourselves. So learn what you are to carry and what God is to carry. Some general tips. God's burden is always the future and the past, since you can't control either. God's burden is everyone else out there, since you can't control them. God's burden is what you should be doing. You are under his yoke and not your heavy one. It's rather simple. Each day you look up, take orders, and get the grace to do them, and leave all the rest into his hands. How we view trials is huge. Perspective. In your trial, how do you view yourself? Are you to be pitied or praised? Is this a blessing or a curse? It is an honor or a punishment? Is this trial indication that you are loved or unloved? How do you view God? Is he kind or severe? Does he love you or is he out to get you? Is he good or is he being bad to you? Let me give you an example. For my own situation, that can be viewed in two different ways. Now, first of all, for those of you who don't know, that last trial I described was actually not the worst. The worst was yet to come, when he found out that our beautiful daughter had MS. So with that said, here are the two perspectives. Oh, God is so harsh. We have gone from one trial to the next, little break on the mission field. Then, instead of giving us a breather, God hammers us with a series of huge whammies that sends us reeling. First with the war, losing everything we loved, then losing my health for 8 years of intense suffering in which my daughter took over my job and gave herself sacrificially for years. Then I was healed, for which I'm very thankful, but 6 months later, we find out that my daughter had MS, which is all the thanks she got from God after all her years of sacrifice. Now she has to suffer the rest of her life after having helped me so faithfully and not gained the ideal life she had wanted, probably never marry, or have kids and die young of an invalid. How could you be so cruel? Okay. Same situation. Isn't God good? He put us through smaller trials and taught us how to grow with each one to gain a platform of his faithfulness on which to stand when the bigger trials came. He was so kind in doing this because we were not broadsided when we hit a huge one, which was the war and then my deteriorating health. And that was a gift in and of itself because he taught me so much. During the time when I was down about who he is, I gained such precious jewels that I would not trade for the world, things I can now help others with. Then when my daughter got MS, I was now ready to help her through her struggle by passing on what God had already taught me. She was able to get a handle on her trial and look to God in faith and joy. Isn't God good to have put me through first, so I would then be ready to help her when she needed it? Isn't God good to give her something that would allow her to glorify him in the highest sense, to gain what is really valuable, and that won't be taken from her? And, in his goodness, isn't God good that she did marry a wonderful young man? So which is it? Is God good, or is he cruel? Same situation, different perspectives. How do you view your own story? That there is a speeding car out of control with no driver in it and you're in the back seat? Or is there a driver to the car who knows where he is going? Did you get caught in the machinery? Or was this all planned and you're right on course? It all depends on how you look at it. You can relax if you know there is a good driver up in front. The fact that you have the trial at all is really God's burden and not yours. All that you need to know is that he is good and he has your good in mind. You can say, I don't know why you are being so severe on me, but I know you, and that's good enough for me. And I do this talk, I just started up a blog. I can put it out to the Christ Church what that blog name is. I don't remember it at the point, but this, I'm not normally a blog person, but anyhow, this will be on it. And I do have like a prayer group that meets once a month that people who are suffering come to. And, you know, anyone is welcome. You can let me know if that's something that interests you. And I write devotionals about once a week. And I was just sending it out to them. And but I was encouraged to get a blog and actually put those on the blog. So if you do go on my blog, you'll be seeing a lot of this type of things. You know, encouragement and how to handle trials. Thank you very much.